Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, as young Mozambicans continue street protests against October's election results, fears are growing that there could be serious bloodshed on the streets of the capital.
You know, I'm scared because there will be a concentration of hundreds of thousands of young boys in Maputo city center. And this march is not organized. So it's going to be a spontaneous movement of hundreds of thousands of young in Maputo. And the police is ready to shoot them.
Why is there no money to properly compensate the 50,000 victims of the Ugandan rebel commander Dominic Ongwen?
What we are lacking at the moment is a support that is commensurate with the size of the new cases that the ICC has convicted and is putting at risk the sustainability of the reparation programs. We need renewed support to the reparations at a volume that is commensurate to the need.
And the reasons behind the massive shortages of fuel and foreign currency across the continent. It's Thursday, the 7th of November. First, we go to Maputo. The streets of the Mozambican capital are heavily patrolled by soldiers and police today. They are out in force to try and contain ongoing protests against the election results that gave the victory to the ruling party candidate. The protests have intensified over time, spreading to different parts of the country and including demands for jobs, for health and education infrastructure, and an end to corruption. At least 18 protesters and one policeman have been killed since the protests began. Amnesty International says this is the largest crackdown in nearly 20 years. These are the voices of young people preparing to take part in the protests.
I'm well prepared. This country belongs to us. Save Mozambique. We voted for Venancio. We don't want Chapo. No more dictatorship in this country. All Mozambican youth suffer. You finish the 12th grade, but you go selling in the market while their sons are living well and better. This country belongs to us. Save Mozambique.
We are prepared. We will claim 100% of our votes. It will be the day that we will rescue Mozambique from the oppressor. It's the day we will go from here singing in union to rescue the country. We're united by Venancio's cause, the people's cause. Let's all be worried to rescue Mozambique. Even if some lives have to be sacrificed, we are going to rescue Mozambique.
The voices you just heard were recorded yesterday. The opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, is outside of Mozambique. He says he fears for his life and has been communicating via social media. And he says the atmosphere in Mozambique today is revolutionary. Mozambique's neighbor, South Africa, is a bit nervous, so it has closed one of the busiest border crossings. Municipal buildings have been burned down at the crossing, and some officials are reported to have fled to South Africa for safety. João Veijo is a journalist in Maputo, and he's been following these events closely.
The concentration will be in Maputo for Thursday, but since last week, every day there are these demonstrations in almost all the provincial capitals of Maputo, and not only in the provincial capitals, in all small districts as well. The border to South Africa is closed because of riots that happened over there with destruction of all the customs. And in many cities of Maputo, there are these simultaneous riots with confrontations with the police and the burning of dozens of Frelimo headquarters offices and the destruction of other infrastructures, including revenge against the police, because they are being accused of killing the demonstrators. So few policemen have already been killed, with images in videos being viral showing the lynch and the killing of policemen. So the situation is very tense.
So the defense minister has threatened to deploy the army ahead of the nationwide protests.
Yes.
That are called for Thursday. Are you seeing any sign of that? Are they out on the streets?
No, not yet. It was a demonstration of force that the Ministry of Defense did. He said that if necessary, the militaries will be in the streets. It was a nonsense speech. Because in a situation like this, it should be the president to speak to the nation in a more unified speech. And he sent the Ministry of Defense, who is not responsible to control this situation. The responsible should be the Ministry of Interior or the Ministry of Home Affairs. And they are trying to solve a political economical problem, analyzing it as a security problem. It's not possible because there are hundreds of thousands of youth very angry with Frelimo and with the government, very tired with these situations of increasing of poverty and social exclusion and social inequalities. And now they have a leader, very charismatic leader, that they will follow until the end. They lost their hope. They don't have nothing to lose. And they will follow the leader until the end because the majority of the population already realized that the elections are very politically manipulated and there is no chance for the opposition parties to get to the power through the elections way. So the message is that violence is the only alternative.
So where is Mr. Moldani?
He's abroad. Seems that he's in Europe between Holland or Switzerland. He escaped from Mozambique to South Africa. From South Africa, it seems that he went to Holland and from the Netherlands, he went to Switzerland. But it's only rumors. No one really knows. There is this speculation that he will be in the march in Maputo. It will be a very dangerous scenario because he can be killed. And if he will be killed, I would say that the reaction of the youth will be very unpredictable and terrible riots could follow.
Do you genuinely think that Mr. Mondlane could be assassinated? I know he's out of the country now because he says he fears being killed. But if, as you say, the reaction to him being killed will be so huge, do you really believe that there are forces in the country that would take the risk?
I couldn't believe that his lawyer would be killed, and he was. So the assassination was an assassination to the rule of law, was an assassination to democracy, to civil rights. And after that assassination, there was this escalation of violence. So if it was possible to kill his lawyer using machine guns with many cameras around without any criminal investigation, making us believe that it was a crime committed by the defense and security forces or by a faction of defense and security forces, I wouldn't surprise that they would also kill President Mondlane, also because there were many rumors that the target was also Venancio Mondlane and not only his lawyer.
Are people on strike from work as well as the street protests?
The majority of the population in Maputo, they live from the informal market. The transport system, it's not a public transport, it's from small vans. Most of them are private. So when all this private informal sector stay at home, it can paralyze 90% of economy of Maputo. So the majority of stores, restaurants, shopping centers and offices in Maputo are closed. I would say that like at least 70% of them are closed, at least since last Thursday. So it's going to be 1 week of strikes. When we use the word strike in Mozambique, it doesn't have the same meaning as it has in developed countries, because the majority of the population lives from the informal market. It can mean riots, it can mean looting. It's a social chaos with burning tires, blocking streets with police firing real bullets. The youth are responding, throwing rocks or throwing garbage to the streets or even lynching the police. So it's very violent, the strike in the suburbs of Maputo.
Are there any other moves on the part of the government to calm the situation and not just the quelling of it through using the police and threatening to use the army?
No, there is no way. Frelimo, after 49 years of governance, they live in a parallel reality. They become used to this manipulation of electoral results, politicizing all the state institutions, manipulating all of them, including the defense and security forces that they use against the population. But nowadays, among the defense and security forces, there are plenty of members who are discontent, and the risk of they revolt against the government and the system is very high. In fact, Frelimo and this regime seems very strong, but it's very fragile, and it can fall down every moment because the level of discontent, the level of anger against Frelimo, especially last 1-2 weeks, it increased to a level of hate against the system among the youth, especially after the killing of these young by the police.
So how are ordinary people feeling in Mozambique as they wait for these protests to continue?
There is a general consensus. Everybody is very tired. Yesterday and on the day before, in the central neighborhoods of Maputo, in my building as well, everybody come, or I wouldn't say everybody, of course, but at least 50%, we can see on videos that at least 50% of the population of each building come to the balconies and start to shout and making noise with the vuvuzelas and shooting with pans and making a lot of noise. And this noise was listened in the palace of the president.
You were saying you are very scared. Tell me a little bit more about that, as you know, as ordinary people in Mozambique.
You know, I'm scared because there will be a concentration of hundreds of thousands of young boys in Maputo city center. And this march is not organized. There is no one who can be responsible for this because this is not allowed. So it's going to be a spontaneous movement of hundreds of thousands of young in Maputo. And the police is ready to shoot them.
That's the Mozambican journalist João Feijó in Maputo. When the International Criminal Court, the ICC, sentenced Dominic Ongwen, a former commander of the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, to 25 years in prison in 2021, there was hope that full justice would be served on the victims in northern Uganda. It was a hope held by the victims and survivors of the atrocities committed by Ongwen and his army in the north between 2002 and 2005. Those people, thousands of them, had followed the case at the ICC keenly for years.
The chamber has therefore convicted Dominic Ongwen of a total of 61 crimes, compromising both crimes against humanity and war crimes.
There was joy and relief when he was found guilty, and the expectation of reparations. The court awarded about $56 million to the victims. That's the equivalent to 210 billion Ugandan shillings in today's money, and it is the largest reparation order in the history of the International Criminal Court. But not a single country, institution, or donor has made a contribution to the trust fund for victims. Why is that? After all, justice is incomplete without reparations. But the situation is not that straightforward. Deborah Ruiz Verduzco, the executive director for the ICC Trust Fund for Victims, has some answers as to why that is the case. Just explain to our listeners what the Trust Fund for Victims is and how it operates.
The International Criminal Court was created to deliver justice for the most serious crimes under international law. That is the crime of genocide, the crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. But the ICC was also created to deliver justice that is reparative. So it's not only concerned with finding who are the responsible of the crimes and ensuring that they are held accountable. The ICC is also concerned with the impact of those crimes on the victims. And victims in cases that are convicted by the ICC are able to receive reparations. That means that when somebody is found guilty, that person will serve imprisonment sentence and they will also be given an order to pay for these reparations. The ICC judges will determine how many victims are affected by the crimes, what is the type of harm they suffered, and what is the value that should be paid to them. And then the trust fund comes into place to be the mechanism through which these reparations are paid. So in principle, the convicted person should transfer this money to the ICC, and then the ICC judges transfer them to the trust fund. And it is our responsibility to administer these resources through programs for the benefit of victims. But in reality, it has happened to date that none of the persons that have been convicted have the resources to pay for these reparations. And therefore, the role of the trust fund is also to mobilize resources from other sources, from other places, from public resources, that means states or organizations can give us contributions, or the private sector can also give contributions, that means companies or foundations or individual donors.
Why is it that no person found guilty of any war crimes has been held accountable in this way financially and paying reparations? Is that because they didn't have money, or the ICC trust fund can't find the resources, or there just are no resources? If states and other private donors are not contributing, why are they not contributing?
For the ICC to be able to secure resources from the convicted person, first, the convicted person needs to have those resources. And second, there needs to be state cooperation for those resources to be frozen during the trial and then transferred to the ICC after the trial. The analysis to date has been that the individuals do not have the resources.
So why is it that countries who are signatories to the Rome Statute have not contributed to any of these funds if there are shortfalls?
Indeed, no. So the state's parties to the ICC have contributed to the trust fund since we were created in 2004. To date, we have received 52 million euros from 52 states that are parties to the ICC. Every year, we receive resources from them, approximately 3 million euros. And these resources were sufficient at the beginning of the existence of the ICC because the programs were just starting, and therefore the system was being set up. And there were not yet convictions. But since the first conviction in the case of Thomas Lubanga, and then the first reparation program that has been started and that has been completed last year in the case of Mr. Germain Katanga, both in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, these contributions have paid already for a number of reparation programs. So the Katanga reparation program that was worth $1 million has been fully funded by the state's parties. And the program for the reparations in the Almadi case in Mali that concerned the destruction of the Timbuktu mausoleum was also funded by states parties for 2.7 million euros. So there has been contributions. What we are lacking at the moment is a support that is commensurate with the size of the new cases that the ICC has convicted. The Ongwen reparation program involves 50,000 victims. And this is a big contrast with the 300 victims in the Katanga case. So that means that the level of contributions that we have received to date in the past 20 years is not sufficient and is putting at risk the sustainability of the reparation programs. We need renewed support to the reparations at a volume that is commensurate to the need.
So, yeah. The shortfall in funding for victims of Dominic Ongwen, it's yeah. not because they're victims of Dominic Ongwen, if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly. It is because states have not realized that they need to contribute money in order to pay reparations. So it's essentially exactly. an oversight. It's not directed at the fact that these people are victims of this particular man.
Yes and no. Indeed, it is on the one hand, it is an oversight. They were not prepared for this order. They have not, you know, been aware that this was coming, and they have not made those resources available. At the same time, however, many with whom I talk, they are saying, but why should we pay for the crimes of Mr. Dominic Ongwen? We are already paying for the tribunal that is prosecuting him. We paid for outreach. We paid for the investigation. Why should we also pay for the victims? And the answer is, first of all, because reparations really touch the intersection between justice and development. That means that what we're trying to address is, yes, the crimes of the past, what happened to those individuals 20 years ago, but those affectations are still today impeding those communities to be productive and to remain in peace. The continuation of the harm on them, the psychological harm, the economical harm, are latent conditions for violence to erupt or to continue. And therefore, we see reparations as an investment in the future. What we are offering, what we're calling on states, is to think about reparations in a different way. And because they created the ICC for crimes that affect all of us, it is for all of us to contribute to the reparations.
And do you think that states will hear you when you say that and actually see reparations in a different light and then contribute to make sure that the victims of crimes against humanity are actually restored their dignity and are in some way receive some redress for what had been done to them?
I am hopeful that they will do, but we still need to make our case and to be heard and reach all the corners of decision makers. But I believe that we have a good case, that the International Criminal Court is supported, and that those bridges will be built for the victims.
Okay, then. Thank you so much. Thank you very, very much. That's hopeful.
Thanks so much, Audrey.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Audrey.
Deborah Ruiz-Verduzco, the Executive Director for the International Criminal Court Trust Fund for Victims. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. We've been talking about fuel shortages for much of this year. We've also been talking about foreign currency shortages. It seems the two things are linked. In South Sudan, the shortages are so severe, they've disrupted much-needed food aid deliveries. Fuel taxes doubled in Kenya, sending the cost of living sky high. In Nigeria, Cameroon and Malawi, long, long queues have led to frustration, frayed nerves and anger. Prices went up by 20% in Ethiopia. In Sierra Leone, prices have doubled. Malawi has run out of foreign exchange to pay for fuel imports. The pumps are dry. The reserves have run out. What is happening and why? Ali Khan Sachu is a financial advisor and he often helps us understand these issues.
It is specific and it's a spreading problem. The spreading problem is that a lot of these countries have got to pony up foreign exchange. And what it's informing us is that there is a genuine shortage of foreign exchange in many African countries. So that's one problem, and I think that's a symptom that you're seeing across the continent. Then you have specific issues within country, but bear in mind that for oil importing countries, the single biggest line item is, you know, so a lot of people have got their fingers in the pie.
Right, so it's money sort of spreading in different directions as well. Cameroonian officials blame the shortage to ongoing disruptions, of distribution of the oil to stormy weather off the Atlantic coast, and they're saying it's stranding cargo ships at the regional hub port of Lomé, Togo. So, how many countries, for instance, would be affected by that particular circumstance?
I would imagine 3 or 4 countries would be dependent on that logistics hub. So I think that's specific to Cameroon and the neighboring countries in the area. This is spreading east to west. And then, you know, Nigeria, the biggest oil producer, is struggling as well.
We know that there's a war in Sudan, and that obviously disrupts a whole lot of things. But I can't see the army and sort of tanks and so on being stranded because of a shortage of fuel. Are there circumstances in which countries would make very specific plans to make sure that they don't run out of fuel because they need it, not for civilian purposes, but for war, say?
That's interesting. Of course, there's been a tremendous shortage of fuel in South Sudan. The pipeline to Port Sudan was not operational until very recently. So you're referring to that specifically. But obviously, governments provision, particularly their military, and they keep oil depots and keep, you know, vital supplies available in the so-called national interest. So, yes, there is always some kind of buffer, unless there's a total breakdown of law and order, and then the buffer gets sold off as well at enormous profits on the black market.
The fuel crisis has stirred up social unrest in Chad. There have been protests in N'Djamena, the capital, in other towns. Will we be seeing that kind of reaction in other countries as well? Because it seems like there are very many different touch points, in a way, in countries when it comes to social unrest. I'm just wondering whether fuel protests would become the order of the day.
So we saw fuel protests, of course, in East Africa not too long ago, in Kenya. Chad is the latest example. I mean, you've got to bear in mind that fuel is the single biggest input into most Africans' lives. I mean, I would have thought nearly every African is fueling either their moped, their motorbike, or something once a day. So they're highly sensitive. There's a big touch point between fuel and the average African citizen. And we've already seen that sharp price increases cause tremendous distress, ripple through the economy very, very quickly, and impact people's living standards immediately. So I think, you know, fuel is a highly sensitive issue, and, you know, it can be the touch paper for serious problems.
Just explain to us how the fuel import system actually does work. We know that it's the price is pegged in dollars, and because so many countries have foreign currency shortages, it's a problem. But exactly how does it work? Where does, you know, do countries buy from the same sources, or do they buy from different sources? What?
So different countries have different systems, but they, you know, essentially the price of fuel is set in the global markets, and then there are different grades which trade off those global market prices. You factor in transportation. So the further inland you're going, of course, the more expensive it becomes. So if you're a landlocked country, I think the shortages in Burundi and Malawi, for example, the price of fuel is much higher than it would be landed in the port of Mombasa or the port of Durban, naturally, because of the logistics cost. So typically, and then what's happening is a lot of countries are using fuel to load up on the tax. So you'll find that the cost of fuel carries, for example, in Kenya, nearly 100% of the price is actually, you know, the price is doubled because of the amount of tax the government is collecting. So they use it as a very easy way of collecting taxes. So there are tax differentials between different countries. And essentially, that's how the system works. And then, you know, there's a lack of transparency, frankly, because, as I said, it's the single biggest it's the single biggest item on any government's budget, and all kinds of people have their hands in the till, further increasing prices.
Africa has oil reserves. Why is it so difficult to make use of these for the benefit of the continent?
Firstly, there's an issue about demographics. You know, you might have tremendous amount of reserves, but if you have a huge population, when you divide up the reserves by the people, it comes to a very small amount. This is one of the challenges in Nigeria and why Botswana is so rich, because there are about 2.5 million people in Botswana, tremendous coal reserves. And similarly, Namibia will become very rich. And why somewhere like Nigeria will remain poor as long as the population is growing at the pace it's growing. However, you know, looking beyond the demographics and that equation, what you find is that a lot of our systems are simply dysfunctional. Take Nigeria, for example. They discovered oil decades ago, and in many cases, until the recent Dangote refinery, were still exporting that oil abroad in order to refine it. I mean, there is no excuse for any policymaker to do such a thing. And that's a symptom of a disease that's all across the continent, pretty much.
So are there solutions available to solve the fuel shortage across Africa?
To some degree, but I mean, you know, the 54 countries, and you've got different quality of policymakers, and you've got different, you know, scenarios in different countries. In some cases, you know, you've probably got folks who are funding the president who've got a lock on the fuel import system. In other countries, you've got a different challenge entirely, like Malawi, genuinely run out of money. So it's not going to be fixed overnight, but it needs somebody like the African Development Bank or Afrexim Bank to step in and help out, because otherwise it's just going to spread and get worse.
That's a very depressing thought. I mean, are policymakers not interested in solving these problems? Or are there just too many people that benefit from it and not the people who should benefit from it, and that is the citizens of any given country?
Essentially, you know, in most countries you have people who are benefiting from the system as it is. There's no real motivation to change the system if you're coining it. And that's a problem. And it's a problem in many other countries as well, in the Western world. But in Africa, it's a huge problem because, you know, the amount of economic extraction is so huge that the cost to buy off the political system is very cheap.
The financial advisor, Ali Khan Satchu. Focus on Africa was put together by Victor Silva, Bella Hassan and Daniel Dadzi in London. Charles Kitonga and Fene Joey contributed from Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer. Chris Kuzaris was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.